An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Life After God podcast. My name is Ryan Bell and I'm your host. This is episode 39 and I have, I know I say this every week, but I have a really special treat for you today. We have never had at this point a musician on the show who actually played music on the show, but that's what happened this last week as we recorded the podcast. I had the privilege of having Gabby Gordon on the program. She is based here in Los Angeles. She's a Danish-American singer and songwriter. I first heard her perform here in Los Angeles at Sunday Assembly during the second month of my year without God, February 2014. And I was just so, I guess, still in the thick of all of the craziness that was swirling around Year Without God. And I had, you know, intended to go to a Sunday Assembly for quite a while. And she was doing the music that day along with a few band members that were supporting her. And one song in particular stood out to me. And I went home after that and wrote her on Facebook and just thanked her for the song and sort of told her what it had meant to me. It was almost a year later that I spoke for Sunday Assembly here in Los Angeles, and we've crossed paths a few times there and stayed in touch on Facebook and so forth. So it was just super awesome to have her over to the studio along with her husband, Ronan Gordon. Ronan, for his own part, is a very talented and accomplished musician as well. Ronan was born in Jerusalem, in Israel, and has had a passion for music all of his life. He is an accomplished drummer and performs with Gabby and with other folks as well, teaches drums at Musicians Institute here in Los Angeles. And the two of them came over and we had an amazing conversation. You know, her from Denmark, him from Israel, both of them coming from very different backgrounds, but finding each other here in Los Angeles and sort of finding each other in skepticism as well and really connecting over music. It's a fascinating story, very unique story, and one I am so happy to have the chance to record and share with you. So it's a little, perhaps a little bit longer, maybe 10, 15 minutes longer than what I usually do here at the Life After God podcast. So I'm not going to take any more time. I'm going to jump right into it. If you want to learn more about the Life After God podcast, please visit us at our website, lifeaftergod.org. Feel free to drop me an email anytime with comments, suggestions, adoring praise for all the great work we're doing. Ryan@lifeaftergod.org. Thanks so much for tuning in, and please enjoy this conversation with Gabby and Ronan. I first met you guys at Sunday Assembly, and it was February 2014, the second month of my year without God, and you guys were playing music for Sunday Assembly, and you played this song, Power, and I went straight home and wrote you on Facebook. I found you on Facebook. I like stalked you and found you on Facebook, which I guess is, you know, like you have a public profile. That's what people are supposed to do.
Yeah.
and messaged you and said how much I appreciated the song.
Yeah, that was awesome. And I appreciated your speech, and I was super impressed by your journey, and I've followed you since, you know, stalked you on Facebook, so.
There we go.
Interest is mutual, Ryan.
Secretly, you're not. It's a secret. Up until now.
Now
it's done.
Yeah. and then I've heard you play music at Sunday Assembly one other time, and we've just sort of stayed in contact through social media, but it's super exciting to have you guys here.
Yeah. I hope we live up to the expectation.
Yeah. No, excited. I've had some really important people in here, and now you are topping that list, and Oliver's been a good host, I think.
He's been excellent.
Yes.
And we've had Iron Triangle beer. I just like to do a little
shout out. Excellent.
Yeah, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Iron Triangle. They have not paid me any money for that promotion, but we're enjoying the beer nonetheless. Yeah. So anyway, so it's great to have you guys here, and it was super last minute, and I appreciate you making the time. And that song that you played that day I first met you, I think I've persuaded you to play the song for us in just a minute.
Yeah, I'll be happy to whip up some musical jam.
That's great. Yeah, you brought your keyboard and everything. So super exciting. And before we get to that, though, I just want to find out more about your story. We on this podcast, I basically just try to get people's background, their story, their spiritual and religious biography. And I know we were talking offline, and you have a super interesting story. So why don't you just tell me like your sort of your earliest religious memories? Like where does it begin for you?
Oh, well, I was born and raised in Denmark, in Scandinavia, and I grew up in a non-religious home. That's pretty typical in Denmark, I would say. And my father was an atheist, and my earliest memory was definitely the question I put to my mother, is there a God? I don't know why I suddenly asked that, you know, at the age of 5 or 6. But I remember her giving me an open-ended answer that left it, you know, open to interpretation, even to my young ears. I was like, okay, she's not saying no, there is no God. And it sort of got my fantasy going. I remember that pretty clearly. But that was really as much influence as I had. There was no other people in my environment that were really sort of influencing me. But then my life changed. My parents got divorced and we moved to Switzerland, where my stepfather lived, and we moved around a bunch, and I started feeling this need to belong and have stability, some kind of spiritual stability, I suppose, and asked to be baptized, which we'd never been, because my dad, did I mention to say that already or not? I'm not sure either way. My dad didn't want us to be, but then I decided, yes, let's do this. And we got baptized and confirmed some years later.
Was that like a Catholic church or like
Lutheran
or
Protestant
something?
Christian.
Okay.
And then you just go, most kids tend to get baptized there, and then you get confirmed as a teenager.
Right. Yeah.
And we went through that process while we were living abroad in Prague. Me and my brother would, you know, do Bible study.
Oh, yeah.
Learn about the Bible together. And my mom would help us with the homework, and we'd send it back to the priest.
I did the same, only in a much more like evangelical context.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
The pastor would come to the house and like study with me. And
that was exclusive.
Check my, I know, right? I had a private thing with the pastor. Not like that though.
It's a little suggestive.
Yeah, no, not like that.
No, but he was a very nice man too. But I'm afraid not the most inspiring type of educator. And I remember very clearly we were standing there at the altar, you know, where you're supposed to say the, I think it's the Lord's one of those prayers.
The Lord's Prayer.
I forgot it now. And
it's just as well.
Yeah. it was seared into my brain at this point. And my brother, he leans over to my mom. He goes, Mom, I don't think I believe this stuff. And she goes, Nick, shut the hell up. The party's paid for. We're doing this.
And it was the wedding baptism must go on.
Yeah, and that sort of clearly put him on a path. He became kind of a nerdy, science-y, you know, spaceships and stars kind of a guy. And I definitely went the other direction and became very fascinated with all things spiritual. Some people started coming into my life that could see auras or had imaginary friends and could talk to them. And, you know, psychics. I just would meet these people and who had these experiences, supernatural experiences. And I was just fascinated and totally jealous and wanted my own superpowers. And
was this while you're still in Switzerland that this is happening?
It was happening over a bunch of countries. We would meet like these kinds of people, but mainly Prague at the time.
Yeah.
And then beyond, after Prague, England, and then Berlin, and then came to the States.
Wow, you guys were all over the place.
Yeah, and then once I came to the States, especially L.A., you know, California is the place to come for New Age beliefs.
Alternative spirituality.
Alternative spirituality. And I definitely lapped it all up, and I would just immerse myself in this world of laws of attraction and try to find these people who could cultivate my own psychic abilities and help me find myself and be a person in the world. And that's my journey. And I lived that for the first couple of years. And then I met Ronan.
Ronan is also here with us. Hi, Ronan.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
You're the husband.
I am. Yes. And apparently the savior.
Oh, okay. Well, give us your...
Apparently very humble.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Give us your, I guess, your religious backstory, and you were born and raised in Israel, I guess.
Yeah. So, coming from like what I like to call like the mouth of madness, where I was born in Jerusalem, and from a very young age, I think I realized, okay, there's a lot happening in this old city that people have been talking about. So there's a lot of action going on. And, you know, is growing up in Israel, it's almost like there's two realities. There's a secular world where, you know, you're born as you're a Jew, and that's your heritage. And then there's your country's history. You know, it goes back 60 years to the founding founding process of Israel, and then it goes way back. And that's where things kind of, that's where history and religion kind of...
Mythology.
Kind of, and then it's like you're in school and you're learning your history and you're learning your biblical history. And it's just a mix of like the lines are kind of blurred at that point. And as a kid, you don't really realize, you think... Yeah, well, I wonder where the story of Noah happened, and you know, because they talk about mountains and hills and valleys and cities, and you're like, yeah, that's like
right
an
there.
Hour away from here in Bethlehem, and I know that is
right.
So it's much more of a it's confusing because it's real, but also it's just kind of like these fantastic stories of magical beings, and
it would be hearing like stories of Lord of the Rings and actually living in Middle Earth.
In Middle Earth, yeah.
And
you're
being like
Frodo's
oh,
corner is like right down
right there.
There.
Like,
yeah. The Frodo?
Except that nobody's ever seen a Hobbit.
Yeah, no, exactly. They used to live here.
Right. Wow, I never thought of it that way. That's so amazing.
And you're like, yeah, of course they used to live there because that's the name of the street and the hill. So why would they name that hill any other name?
It must be true.
It must be true. So as a kid, you just don't know that. Fortunately, there's a good secular system of education. And my parents come from... I think my parents' experience of coming from they grew up in Latvia, but back then it was a part of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden you have a communist regime, you know, that says, okay, you guys are part of the system. All of a sudden they experience, I think, what I don't know, maybe a different version of organized religion, where all of a sudden the state is the religion.
Yeah.
You just replace your church with the leader of the party.
Right, exactly.
So they came to Israel when they were able to leave Latvia, or leave the grip of the Soviet Union. They you know, they had a more of a suspicious outlook on religion. So
was that in the 40s when the nation of Israel was founded?
Well, Israel was founded in the 40s, but they were able to leave later in the late 60s.
Okay.
There were like several points where the Russians said, okay, you can leave now.
I see.
So they had a very suspicious mindset of organized anything. So right. Organized religion.
Besides the party.
Yeah, yeah. So they were like very suspicious about joining any group too soon. They kind of like wanted to enjoy their freedom. So coming to Israel was a big step. And we grew up in a, it's weird. My grandparents were religious, but they were like, you know, for them going to the synagogue was like a it's like showing, like in Russia they couldn't do that. So like going to the synagogue, being showing that you're Jewish was something like amazing. It was like a part of their life. Like you could show that you're free. You can go and like that's like for them freedom of religion was right. Really something for them. So for them being able to identify as Jews and
like a national pride ethnic pride.
Yeah, and yeah, that's because really religion is mixed in that. It becomes a part of the national character.
Right.
So it's, although the people who founded Israel were very much secular, mm-hmm. almost to the point where they saw the founder of the country, Theodor Herzl, he was very much in the mindset of like the Christian culture of the European culture, where they moved away from their religion and they're kind of more secular. He wanted Israel to be that type of country. He wanted European Jews to come to Israel and really make it a European country. So that was their, that was the experience I lived. I lived like in this Zionist secular society, yet at the same time proud of their biblical ancient history of like this is our land. And it's like, well, okay, what, where? It's like, oh, here's the story 2000 years ago. And here's the proof, and all these magical stories kind of start coming in, and all the holidays, you know, every year there's, you have the story of Exodus from Egypt where all these magical things happened, and
right.
So every holiday there's like a miracle because, you know, in Hanukkah there's like a, that's the temple, they saved the temple for extra days, and
right.
in Passover God let them go through the Red Sea. So there's a lot of these things we consider like, oh yeah, that's, we're celebrating a holiday, but they're so intertwined with
right.
religion. So fortunately I was able to kind of keep a good balance between the magical stories and the historical stories,
right,
and finding a way to live, yeah, respecting religion, but also at the same time having the kind of the good teachers to tell you, okay, you know, you don't have to take every sentence like it's directly written by God. This is an exact, you have to follow every step.
Right.
And while at the same time living in Jerusalem, you can, a couple of blocks away, I had Orthodox Jews who, you know, you could, you know, I know what's a equivalent, but you could think about the Amish, you know, at a certain point they decided,
right,
this is good enough. No new information is necessary.
No new technology.
That is, they dress like, you know, if you see like Schindler's List, and they kind of like, they look like Jews from the early 19th 30s. Centuries.
Yeah.
They still wear the same dress and the same dress code, and they speak Yiddish. They don't speak Hebrew. They live in Israel.
Right.
They don't consider themselves citizens.
Of Israel.
Yeah. I mean, they are, but they're not... they're not a part of the society because they believe that all the only reason they're in Israel is to just to pray,
right,
study the book and worship God, and that's it. So they don't work, they don't participate in society, they're very closed. It's almost like a small cult,
right?
And then you have all these, you know, just like any religion, like one sect is like, we do this, and then they decide to adjust one thing, and then it becomes a whole other sect. And you have these hundreds of small sects of versions of Judaism, of
right.
like strict or more open. And so it's just fascinating for me. I remember just being aware of that at a young age, of like, there's so many versions of this, of being a Jew or being Jewish,
mm-hmm.
that it's kind of like you choose what, you kind of pick and choose. Like, these guys are extremists or less extreme. You want to, you know, it's like a buffet of religion.
Right.
You know, and then, by the way, oh yeah, there's all these mosques and churches, by the way, and they have their own story. Forget about, like, you know. Right.
They have a different
one. There's like
one.
A whole other lineage. Everything is like in like, I don't know, 4 or 5 blocks.
Did you grow up with a real awareness of the Christians and Muslims around you?
Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty obvious that there were other people with different story.
Well, I mean, the majority of the people I interacted with were Jewish people, Israelis.
Right, of course.
But
yeah.
But there's a big community of Israeli Arabs, and there's always this being aware and connected to the people of that place.
Right.
So, yeah, we kind of knew that. Yes, we come from a different country, and they're kind of like more the local mm-hmm. flavor of the land and whatever, the people that
were there, you know, most recently before Israel.
Yeah, and we also had Jews that came from Arabic countries.
Right.
So all of Northern Africa, Tunisia, Morocco, mm-hmm. Egypt, and then you have more, you know, further north, Lebanon and Syria and Iran and Iraq, had all these Jews. It's like Israel became like this melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, I don't know, if you take Manhattan or Long Island, and it's just you pack it with millions of people from all over the world, and you're like, all right, you all have your own interesting, fascinating stories. Get along, right? You believe you're all right.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Right.
And it's just so, it's such a melting pot. It's just so much energy in that place. It's fascinating, but at the same time, you realize that...
Stressful.
Yeah, yeah. It's because people really believe this stuff. This is not, oh, you know, it's just something they picked up in college. And right. they're into it now.
It's like their fraternity.
Yeah.
It's more important than
that. It's really serious.
Right.
It's like, this is where it happened. This is where it all starts. This means everything. This means the world to
right.
some of these people.
How old were you when you left then? You came, your family came to the U.S. or was it just you?
So I kind of went to the Israeli army and you do your service, your national service.
Yeah.
And that's, again, another step. After you're done with high school, you go, you serve the country, and, you know, pretty quickly after, you know, they give you skills and they kind of train you to understand that you're a part of the system. You have a duty to pay back to the country that's given you something, and that's great. I think it's very important for a young person, especially at 18, where you think you're the most important thing on the planet.
Right.
And then they're like, okay, be quiet now. Here's your number. And you're a part of the system and you have to behave and understand your place in this world. So that was important. But pretty quickly I understood that music was always a very important part for me.
Okay.
And it kind of, growing up, I mean, I growing up in Jerusalem with suicide bombings and terror attacks and constant...
Wow.
Just, you know, I've had, next to my school, there was a bus, suicide bomber on a bus. Mm. And, you know, that day the school was off and, you know, that day was, we just escaped that.
But if you had been at school, there would have been casualties in the school. It was that close?
It was really close. So like that intersection that he blew himself up, that was, I walked there hundreds of times.
Wow.
And so it, you know.
That's before the wall and everything.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of people moving to and fro.
Yeah. So we had, when I was growing up, I remember going up to the Temple Mount.
Yeah.
And
wow, when you could still do
that.
Yeah,
you could do that. And it was cool. And
yeah, I didn't get to go there.
Yeah. I'm, it's so charged now, but things kind of escalated fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It started with rocks and stones on the weekends, and then it's all of a sudden you couldn't go to certain areas and certain neighborhoods, and then certain cities were like off limits, and then pretty quickly weapons and all of a sudden terrorists, and then becomes more and more extreme. Like the more countermeasure the Israelis would try and like block off a certain area, it's kind of like a game of cat and mouse or like a chess. You like each side gets better by playing a better opponent. So
that's like the 80s, right? Like that's in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was born in the 80s. So I basically became aware of like there's this battle of ideas happening in this land.
Right.
Pretty much when I was, I think, 6 or 7. So you become, I don't know how often people say, I became politically active around 6 or 7.
Right.
Because all of a sudden you're like, you have right wing or left wing leaning friends in kindergarten or first grade.
Well, you have to. Like, I mean, I think this is a bit of a rabbit trail. We'll hopefully close this rabbit trail soon. But But yeah, in a country like the United States, where we have this relatively peaceful democracy and people step down from power after 4 or 8 years, depending on how, you know, if they get reelected, you know, in a country like Israel, especially in the '80s, you know, you have to be politically active. It's like every day you're confronted with these, you know, small p political questions about how do we live here? How do we live together? Can we live together? What do we do?
Yeah. I mean, just, I remember having stickers on my wall of like from political parties, like, don't let them throw us into the sea and all these, like, you know, kind of like, I'm just thinking about it. It's crazy that I was so young and just, these are the things that I was, you know, I had Transformer stickers and prevent the throwing of the Jews into the sea.
Right.
That's like the...
Like on your computer, like stuck there, like, yeah, Transformers and then like political slogans.
Yeah, I'm into this and I'm into like the right-wing party, like their politics, and I really like Optimus Prime. It's just bizarre.
And if we had Optimus Prime, we would not have to worry about all of this.
Yeah, he would fix everything.
He would fix everything.
It's weird because, I mean, clearly looking back, I didn't have the right tools to really understand the depth.
Correct, yeah.
But, I mean, that's what happens in politics. You know, politicians try to simplify things and, you know, they try to sell you the problem of now.
Yes.
When a lot of times problems started way before everybody was born. No one even remembers why there's a problem, but we just know there's a problem.
Right. Yeah.
Because
wherever you start telling the story, the person who can decide where the story begins controls the story.
Exactly. True. Yeah. You know? So you're dealing with current issues, but you're kind of have this blind spot to what's happening right now because you're going back to the 4th, 7th century or 1st century, where how far you want to go to where things happen, as if that gives you evidence to anything that's relevant today.
I remember when I was touring Israel and the bus tour guide, you know, that was on the bus, and I was with a bunch of Christian pastors, so that's the context. And he was talking a lot about, you know, how this land belongs to the Jews. And we were like, really? Like, okay, how do you, like, based on what? And of course, we're all conservative Christians, and so we believe in the Bible.
Yeah, here's the contract. There's a contract.
Right, and he takes us to Genesis, and he says, all the land here, this belongs. And I you could see the look on these conservative pastors' faces who had, up until that point, taken the Bible literally. And when this Jewish tour guide applied that literally to a political situation, you could see people go, whoa. Well, wait, how do I get out of this?
Yep.
How exactly. do I, you know, because either it's literal or it's not, right? Like it's either literal. And if it is literal, then the land does belong to the Jews and you could wage war as like Joshua did in the book of Joshua to take the land back based on this, you know, ancient Sumerian contract that you have in the book of Genesis.
Yeah.
And, or it's not literal and it's a story and we have to deal with the present political reality based on, you know, present political tools that we have.
Exactly.
Right. And you can't have it both ways, but it was just such an interesting crisis moment, both for me, but I could see in my colleagues' eyes, all of the guys on that trip, and they were guys and they were their wives sometimes. And my wife was there too. And you could see the look of like, wait, this doesn't add up, but I'm not sure I can explain why.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the real consequence of these ideas, you know,
right.
Actually someone has to live this reality. And, and like I said, like in my studies at school, like we used to have like what you call biblical study, but it was like more like you said, these are stories of our people.
Right.
So these are stories.
Yeah. Founding myths.
Yeah. So this is like the best top seller, best book we wrote back in the 1st century. That's our glory. That's the most amazing human achievement we were able to get in the 1st century. But since then, we're going to also have biology and chemistry and other tools of science. We've moved forward from that. So there was always, I've had, you know, conversations about stuff in the Bible, but it's interesting to explore that just as a human story. There's knowledge there.
Sure.
But, and it's also, I think there's a lot of great knowledge there because now we know how much they didn't know.
Right.
And how they had to kind of round out some corners and make up a little bit. They were trying to do the best they could.
Well, any culture, any culture, when you look at the stories they tell, you learn something about them.
Exactly.
Not that the stories are true. To me, the question of whether, if you find, a group of people that can trace their ancestors back to, a tribe in Brazil or something like that. It's not a question of whether the stories they told are true or untrue. That's not even a really legitimate question of whether they're true or untrue. I mean, obviously, they're not all going to be legitimately true, but it does tell you something about them as a people that they would tell those kind of stories. And all those stories have similarities to them, that these are stories of power. They're stories of legitimacy.
Values.
Those Babylonians conquered us and took us into exile, but we overcame and we rebuilt our city. Of course that's the story, right? That's the kind of story you would tell.
Yeah. So that's where that's why I got from those stories. I think coming to the States, I realized how seriously people take, obviously I know how seriously people take religion in Israel, but I kind of knew that, yes, they live it every day. They have to take it seriously. This is real to them. But leaving the state, leaving the Israel and going out, I was just blown away by the amount of energy and devotion and just certainty of certain ideas and stories that people had when they completely couldn't even, this is real for someone. Actually, that street or that hill that you in the book, that's someone's actually fighting over that right now.
Right.
Can see it from their window.
Waging war over whether Hobbiton was actually belonged to Frodo or belonged to somebody else.
Yeah. So basically leaving Israel and coming to the United States was, at that point I wasn't, I kind of realized, okay, I'm not religious.
Mm-hmm.
I knew my Jewish history, and I knew I'm Jewish by kind of being a part of this tribe,
right?
But I'm not a part of the I don't know the ritual or the I didn't
the beliefs or beliefs, whatever.
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't a part of the more Orthodox, more what we consider in Israel religious people.
Mm-hmm.
I was proud to be secular, but I didn't really. No one really talked to me about Oh yeah, that's what you're gonna be now.
Right.
I just knew I'm not this and I'm not that, and that's it. I just didn't belong to all these different groups.
You were kind of part of the mainstream of the culture.
Yeah, right? Actually.
So then, when you're the mainstream, you don't have to think so much about what you are.
Yeah, it's not important.
You're just normal, so to say.
You're just normal, and I just really found after the military service, I found that music was such an important part too. You know, when you live in a country where every hour people are just always checking the news, what's happening. It's like a news-obsessed country. People always want to know what's going on. The news is a huge thing. Politics and constant, because there's war every night on TV. There's something happening.
Wow.
So you're just consumed by that. So music was a great escape, it's weird, but my first drum studio was a bomb shelter because
for a bomb shelter.
Yeah. So, you're supposed to keep a certain space in case we have wars. And I remember being, I think 12 or 13. And when the Iraq war was happening Saddam Hussein was throwing rockets, I had to run with a gas mask into a bomb shelter and hope that missiles are not going to come down. Fortunately, I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, so all of my relatives from Tel Aviv moved from Tel Aviv, from the coast, because he was bombing the coast.
Right.
They moved to live with us for about a month and a half. And we were with gas masks, and all of a sudden you have to learn how to inject yourself with there's a syringe. You have to, if there's get chemical gas. All these things you don't think as a 12-year-old kid you have to go in case of a nerve gas attack, you should inject yourself with this EpiPen that has a specific antidote for the gas.
Wow.
And you're 12 and you have to go get training and all that. And the
my
whole
daughter's
family,
12, and so I'm just trying to imagine her having to do
that. And you're in case of a missile attack. So things are just the scope of reality living in that wow. country. And even recently, like, you know, they had a rocket attack recently, and I have nieces and nephews in Israel now, and they know what to do in case of a rocket attack. They know where to go, where to run.
We did earthquake drills.
Yeah.
We had to go under the desk. And
yeah.
Like,
remember that, like, I think, like, those movies that the duck and with the atom bomb thing,
yeah.
Against the Soviets, where the atom bomb, like, tuck and roll, whatever, the get duck under a table or something.
Right.
So, you know, you realize this is like how the society is charged. Like, that's the level of readiness. The population has to be kind of
right.
huddled together, be ready for the situation. So, again, the music was always this escape tool. It was first of all, it was universal. And coming to America was very close. It felt very natural because American culture is very close to Israel, and everybody living in Israel, we all have TV shows and American culture. And we always had those, you know, those stories of these preachers who come to Israel and do these, like, you know, you kind of hear these stories of mega churches and all the people who touch people and they fall and all these kind of magical things. You kind of almost look at it as like a bit of a circus in Israel, because I don't know. We have the old school, and that seems like the new school of like, it's a more theatrical, and it's kind of funny looking
yeah,
at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, we had some channels on TV that they kind of sometimes they would show that. I think it was called the 700 Club.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Pat Robertson's channel.
Yeah, and it was interesting.
At first, when you started describing that, I thought you meant like a comedy TV show that was like making fun of that. But you're actually talking about
the actual thing.
The real deal.
Yeah. And, you know, at the same time, we also have the whole Islam, you know, the whole historical and the people living there and their whole cult culture there as well.
Right.
Which is like, again, another whole world of conflicting ideas at times.
Right.
To you know, not it was kind of like at times... Western values. When I was growing up, it's kind of like, oh, we're Western, and they're not. They don't like the West.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, they don't like Jews, and they don't like the Jewish faith. And then it was like, okay, they also have a problem with Christianity. And it's kind of like just became, you know, you become. At first, I thought it was like more of a political battle, and then you grow up and you realize there's a background to all of this that's more biblical in nature. And there's, again, like you said, the conversation, it's all of a sudden we're not even talking about political problems, we're talking about deep history and verses and quotes that just why is it relevant?
It's all mashed together.
All of a sudden you feel like, wait, now I have to be proficient in every holy text to talk about solving this issue.
Right.
So you could just get discouraged about the situation. And I think that's what people in Israel, they try to live in the real world, and at the same time they have to come to grip with this worldview that a lot of people in that area hold, of this prophecies and magical things that gonna happen, and you just wait, is someone's coming back and something's gonna happen. So yeah, it's a very interesting world to kind of constantly juggle reality and mysticism in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
So take me to where you guys met, Gabby. Tell me, like, or maybe that's not the next step. I don't know. Like, where do you want to go next?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say, I think it's super interesting to listen to Ronan tell you. There's a lot I'm learning about your past from this interview.
That's awesome.
I mean, we go to Israel a lot. We've been to the old city in Jerusalem and the ancient sites. So you know, when you see it, I think you were mentioning that when you saw it for the first time, it kind of hit you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that it's interesting. We come from two very different backgrounds. You were sort of immersed in a religious part of the world, and it's in your face. And that had an effect on how you came out of religion. And I came from, even though you were secular, it was just, I mean,
yeah. always around you.
And yeah. I grew up in probably the most secular part of the world, in Scandinavia.
Right.
And, And I think I wanted something special to latch on to and wanted something colorful and exciting and bigger than maybe that appealed to my sort of artistic, dramatic sensibilities. And yeah, that's what took me on that journey. And when you and I met, we just started having conversations about it, didn't we? You know, yeah. Sort of like being spiritual was a big deal for me at the time. So it would come up very often with people I would meet. And and we quickly established that we definitely didn't share the same opinion. And we would just have these back and forth conversations about it. And I would pull up these books I was reading and you would reference something else. And I always felt like I was coming up short in my arguments. And I just, at the end of the day, this was over obviously like the first couple of years of our relationship, I would say, but we definitely, I personally felt like it always stopped at the choice to believe, making that leap. And I couldn't justify making that leap anymore. It just at a certain point felt super silly, especially because I felt I'd had so many experiences being a spiritual person and living that realm that had really damaged me and made me like a little messed up in the head.
Well, let me stop right there and actually say and ask you, like, what did your spiritual exploration, like first of all, how many years did you spend kind of really diving into that kind of spiritual world?
I would say it was definitely from the age of like 13 onwards, 13 to 18.
Okay.
Started, you know, the auras and the crystals and being into sort of cutesy fairies and angels and energy and psychic abilities. And I would, then I, you know, became aware of religions of the world. And at school, they would present us with religious studies, like, and show us the different religions. And there wasn't, you know, an option of a non-religion, right, at the end of the book. Like, there's also these people who don't, you know, adhere to any kind of religion. So it kind of felt like a menu of pick one, you
right,
know?
Right.
That was the same for me. It was like, you got to be somewhere, but there is no, was no other.
Right. Yeah. And I thought Buddhism looked best at the time. It was more peaceful, in my opinion. And so I started, you know, getting into that here in LA. I'd go to the Bodhi Tree bookstore and, like, look up all these, you know, spiritual ways to find myself. And were you asking me about why I had a negative impression of it?
No, I was really just wanting to know, like, you mentioned how that worldview or that mindset did damage to you. And I would love to know about that. But I also am curious if it helped you in some way, too. At first, or did it evolve from like being this like it kind of helped you find your place in the world for a minute and then it started having a negative effect? Or how did that?
I think that it was deceptively helpful. It was like these, it's like when you go to a conference and you get a boost for a weekend and then you go home to the real world and you have to apply it. You know, I'd go listen to these gurus talk or go have a psychic tell me something important about myself and I'd lap it up. And then I would go home and try to decipher how that was all going to happen for me and what these messages they were interpreting for me meant. And, so I was on a high from that initial meeting because they would tell me, you know, things were going to be great. They always tell you positive messages. And then of course things would go wrong and I'd sit there and think, what the fuck? You know, I'm not attracting the right energy. You know, my juju's off and I don't have, you know, the laws of attraction down yet. And so I think the way it was damaging was that, sure, it allowed me to have a lot of emotional expression, you know, you're delving into like existential questions, but you're trying to answer them. I was trying to answer them by letting other people tell me what is real. I like psychics and spiritual healers and people who could see auras. And I think that the way it was damaging is that I put myself in a very vulnerable position where I give them all this power, you know, over me. Which is, yes, hint, hint. And I would just get wound up with people. You know, when you open the door to spirituality and you make that leap, especially New Age community, I think it's, you are allowing everything in. You right. are saying, yeah, fairies, demons,
dragons,
you know, rocks that talk, dragons, whatever you want to believe, angels.
The inanimate parts yeah. of your house have energy, yeah. right?
Like absolutely.
They influence
yes.
you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all possible, right? So if you're hearing voices in your head, sure, you know, that's totally real. I mean, I read Conversations with God, you know, this book right. series, and then sure enough, surprise, like 2 weeks later, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was having this full-blown conversation with God, and it was real, and I woke up my mother up to tell her about this profound thing, you know, and she looked a little worried at the time and patted me on the head, and I went back to bed, you know. Ugh. But I was like having this euphoric night, right? And I'm just thinking to myself, well, that's now I think of that, and it's just totally crazy. You know, I was sort of convincing myself I was having a full, hearing voices in my head.
It's almost like a drug trip. Like you're having these really crazy experiences, yeah. which seem super real when you're having them.
Absolutely.
But when you come down from it, you're like, oh, that was quite a trip.
Yeah. yeah. Exactly. It's like one of those people in the church and they fall backwards and they get hysterical and they're like shaking all over and having these very real symptoms of their, you know, spiritual awakening. I think it's like psychosomatic. And I felt like over the years I was becoming quite psychotic. Maybe that's an extreme word to use, but I mean, if I was just experiencing things in a way that was, I don't think, healthy for this, for a person who needs to live in the physical real world.
Right.
And I was getting myself wound up with people who I put my trust in because I would say, oh, well, we met for a reason. You know, this creepy old dude at the bookstore who I'm going to go sit in the park with, and he's going to play me his flute and like talk about how, you know, God talks to him through rocks.
That actually happened.
Yeah, you know, that's valid. And I probably shouldn't have been driving anywhere with this guy as an 18-year-old. And, but I was just like, it's whatever, man, you know? I would just lap up their words. And it's kind of humorous now, but I would really submerge myself at like almost cultish, you know, just like allowing other people to tell me what's real and then get frustrated that I didn't have answers and wonder why I had no capabilities. And speaking of music, I would, you know, I thought I had divine channeling through my music. So everything that I would come up with was like a godsend. And it made me trust my abilities. Like if I sit down right now, it's because God's trying to talk through me, you know, through music. And, that was very powerful for me. It moved me. And, and I felt like my purpose in life was to do this. So very seduced by it. But then I think ultimately it doesn't help. And I'll just mention one other thing that in a way that I think can be damaging is, for example, like I would not seek out the right help that I would need. Right. So I would, for example, one time I was in an airport and what I now can recognize was like a full blown anxiety attack just in the middle of this airport. And, you know, someone had to go get me ice cubes to put down my back. I mean, I was just stressing out like crazy. And at the time I told myself, oh, well, it's like, I must have like brushed shoulders with someone who had a demon on them, or, you know, it's just super bad energy that I'm like taking on.
Right.
And that's making me have this attack.
Wow.
Whereas like now I would totally be like, homegirl, you need to go see a psychologist, you know, get some cognitive behavioral therapy and some skills to deal with your anxiety, because that's what it is.
Right.
It's not some demon. And, you know, that would have been a healthy response. But instead I was like, oh, it's just negative energy and the vibes of some creepy stranger. And you know, it's just it's a little right. psycho,
right?
Yeah. So yeah, that's how I think it can go really wrong.
And so when you guys met, were you still kind of in that world? And you sort of were like, you seem like a nice person, but that's crazy. Or
yeah, I think the spirit, when I came to LA, the spirituality seemed like cool. It was like refreshing, like, yeah, all these crystals and, you know, it was like, I think that the interesting part was that they kind of brought a lot of pseudo concepts from the East.
Right.
Like Eastern philosophies that, you know, that's the interesting part is that it always has something that really appeals to people. It has some knowledge and actual, you know, worthy things to explore, but it also intertwined at the same time with super magical, unbelievable tool set that just doesn't give the participant the ability to judge, okay, this is where you need this tool.
Right.
You know, because it's like giving someone a magic wand that might be good for poking into a little hole, but you can't move a mountain of emotional trauma with that magical wand.
Or it's good for a 3-year-old to play pretend, but when you're 18 exactly. or 19 or 25, now it's just a little piece of plastic or a piece of metal or something. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's appropriate at a certain point, but then you become more aware of what's real.
Yeah.
And I think you said something really profound, I think, which is that, you know, as a person living in the real world, you need to be able to distinguish between what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think people who are genuinely psychotic, can, you know, have lost at least momentarily or maybe permanently, who knows, depends on the person, the ability to do that. They've lost the ability to say, you're real. I'm sitting here talking to you. You're real. Mm-hmm. The person who seems like they're in my left ear here, that's just a voice in my head.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
when you're schizophrenic, for example, like you can't make those distinctions. It all seems muddled up in your head. And
right.
Yeah. I think
it's like a self-induced kind of psychosis.
And it was totally self-inflicted, you know, but all based on these intentions of wanting to be a good person in the world and like have a deeper a sense of self and develop my sense of self.
So what was the breaking point for you? Can you think of a moment that was like, wait a minute, I have to rethink this?
Well, I think it might have been before I even met you, when I went and I actually did seek out some therapy, you know, and I had told the therapist, she was a regular clinical psychologist, I believe, and she had I told her that I was into spirituality and stuff, or you know, I'd use the phrase, I don't believe in, you know, the typical God, but I'm spiritual type of thing. And then like session 2 or 3, she stopped mid-sentence and said, I just want to let you know, I'm having a moment where I'm channeling something on your behalf. I just want to share this. I have to share this message with you.
Whoa.
And this was my therapist, right? And she started going into this 5-minute monologue of channeling positive psychic messages to me. And
what?
And at the time, of course, I was like, oh, wow. You know, I felt very special and flattered and, again, just sucked in and went away thinking about it. And then I came out of my haze a little and I was like, that was pretty fucked up. That was my clinical therapist muddying the waters between, you know, a very distinguished, profession, I think, or field,
right,
with something completely unrelated and not, you know.
So for her to do it seemed odd to you, even though you were prone to do it,
because I saw them as two separate things, you know. Right. Clinical psychotherapy is this dry, like, you know, worldly science-y stuff, which I sort of wrote off because I think it closes your mind to spirituality, was my thinking at the time. And then, whoa, here she is, like, now talking my language. And I just was like, this is weird. And
I came to you because you're different than me, right? Yeah. Like, if I wanted to hear that, I could go, like, talk to my girlfriend over here who will.
I have this rock that's excellent.
I think what it did is it really, to pinpoint it, is that it awoke my skepticism for the first time in years.
Wow.
And I think steadily I had been giving that up. That power away, my skepticism. And that's what was awoken in that moment. And then especially when I met Ronan, because he comes from a very skeptical mindset because
that's
of how he grew up and then
being Jewish.
Yeah, it's like question everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish everybody could see what you did with your hands. Yeah, question everything with your hands.
Kind of a Bernie Sanders, like,
Let me
tell you something.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So based on those conversations, I admired that in Ronan when I first met him, and he was definitely an influence on me in that respect, because he was the first person I'd met that was a very balanced individual, a good person, and had healthy interests and many interests, and and lived in the real world and was intelligent. And I could see that there was a huge disconnect between my way of behaving and thinking and what I was experiencing and the way that he was thinking and behaving and what he was experiencing. And I just saw that as more healthy over time. And I definitely think since that point, I developed a healthy psychology over the years.
You've talked a few times now about, like, you've used this language of surrendering your power. And I mean, this is really, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, what this song is about that I first heard you perform, isn't it? I mean, did it come out of this experience, that song?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. It was Ronan was part of the development of that song, and we sort of hashed out some ideas, but it is a mixture of people who took advantage of my willingness to give them my power and
trust and just abusing that,
and then also this godly power that you're falling at the knees of
this
power,
great unknown
and people who know better, whether it's a priest or spiritual healer, somebody who has knowledge over you that is supernatural, and you are just handing your power to them and authority. And I'm like, it corrupts, I think.
And what's implicit in that, it seems to me, and I think you bring this out in the song, is that you're not enough. Like, you don't have the answer, right? Like, and of course, no one of us has all the answers, right? Like, we have to turn to other people for resources. But you're talking about saying, like, I'm not enough. In the core of my being, I'm not enough.
Yeah. Exactly.
I need this other person to validate me or make me better or something.
Yes, it's true. And it's very flattering. And I keep using the word seduce because it is kind of a seduction, when you meet. I would like, kind of like an obsessed groupie. It's comforting, but I'd like also latch on to these spiritual healers and because I thought it made me somehow part of a higher plane.
Did you ever see the documentary Kumare?
No.
Oh,
I think
you have to see this.
Oh, wait, is this the one where he fakes being a healer?
Oh,
a guru.
Guru.
The Indian
guy.
He's a Vice reporter, I think.
Yeah, and he basically starts off just curious, like, why people become followers of gurus.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, at first you think he's playing around, but he's genuinely curious, like a journalist, because he's a journalist. So he says, not to make fun of anyone, but genuinely, like, why do people do that? Why do some people latch onto gurus, maybe other people don't, or whatever? And he has this idea that fake being a yogi or
mystical powers.
It's a fascinating film on so many levels, because at first it sounds like he's just exploiting people's trust, but there's some powerful lessons that come out of it. Those of you listening, if you haven't seen the film, I highly recommend it. About 6 or 8 months ago, it was on Netflix. It may still be.
I think we saw it on
Netflix.
We did
see it,
It's so good. And what you're saying reminds me of so much of some of the characters, because it's a documentary, isn't it? So the people in it are real people who are just so, and I hope this doesn't sound offensive, but so gullible.
Gullible.
Very gullible. And the gullibility is a kind of almost a sweet innocence about
it.
Right? It's not like you're stupid.
No.
Right. Because it's not like, oh, you're gullible, meaning you're not intelligent. It's a kind of, there's almost a kind of aspirational quality to it for me. Like, I wish the world was like that. I wish that you could just implicitly trust everybody you meet, right? And just say, you have my best interest in heart. And I think I love you. I want to be your friend. And, like, I'm going to let you have the keys to my house. And I'm going to, like, let you watch my children, because what could possibly go wrong with that, right? Like, imagine if we lived in that world. That would be an amazing world to live in. But we don't live in that world, right?
Yeah.
And I think I know in some religions they kind of evoke that childlike,
right? Christianity trust. Specifically speaks about
it's
that.
It's like this. There's a very strong imagery of that. Just like, remember that trust that you had, very maternal,
childlike faith.
Yeah. It's and then there's also the whole sheep and leader kind of a flock and sheep kind of followers.
Right, conditioning you to be susceptible. To a powerful leader,
and it's encouraged. Too, because it implies that you are more open to receiving messages of hope and spiritual guidance if you are, not letting skepticism get in the way, this cloud of,
letting
of
go,
you know, all these reason and skepticism, things that we would think are obviously good. We probably agree that those are good things, but that in that kind of realm, they are roadblocks to this whatever this open
right
vessel.
What's so fascinating about what you're saying is when I was a Christian, and especially the more conservative phase of my Christianity, I was taught to fear the New Age movement, and it was from the devil. It was really like
tricking you.
Right. Spiritualism was the evil angels and the evil powers of the world, the devil and all of his minions, basically using what limited spiritual power they had to deceive people and trick people. But what's interesting is that we were taught the same skepticism about skepticism, right? So we were also taught not to really, like, if you... I remember explicitly being taught not to trust my own reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because your mind is fallible, and it is, right?
Yeah.
And you're susceptible to outside influences, which we are.
Mm-hmm.
But what we really need to do is surrender ourselves to God and the Holy Spirit, and that would guide our thinking. But when you start digging into that and you say, well, like, so surrendering yourself to God and the Holy Spirit, what does that mean actually? Because I don't see any God or Holy Spirit standing around here. So what it really means is surrendering yourself to the church or to religious leaders, right? Which is what you did, only it wasn't Christianity. It was this vague kind of abstract spirituality, whatever you want to call it. So what's so fascinating for me is that I was taught to fear people like you, but we were actually under the sway of the same thing.
I agree.
Yeah. Yet at the same time, you had absolute certainty. And there's like, because I had this conversation, a friend of mine, his father is a very religious person, and he lives in Europe, but he's open to skepticism about almost everything except the certainty of eternal life and that Jesus is the Son of God.
Right.
There is no, it's like these, there's always room for debate until you reach those 2 points, and there is no room for doubt, because you can't have doubt in that.
Right.
The minute you introduce like that 1.1%, what if? The minute you start asking yourself that question, that whole theory kind of collapses, because you can't have doubt in that. These are the two premises: that eternal life. Done.
Right.
No doubt.
I go back to Jenga, man. I go back to Jenga. Like,
oh, yeah.
Those things are like the bottom blocks. You pull that out, the whole thing comes down.
But also it's terrifying, right? Because if you do have doubt, and then there's so much superstition attached to, you know, bad things that will happen to you if you start sowing the seeds of doubt. And at least, I don't know if you relate to that, Ryan, at all, but that's kind of where I would go, you know, the minute I would start having a sliver wait a minute type of, you know, brain fart, then it would quickly disappear again out of fear, because I would think, you know, okay, well, I'm closing off myself to a better life, and to
so it's the same
messages.
Guilt and shame that controls you. So I remember going to this thing called WorldWorks, which was like this human potential training kind of course, and I learned a lot of good stuff from it. You know, I really did. But there was always this kind of shame if you weren't able to be your best self at any given moment, and that was a kind of tool that the teachers or the gurus or whatever, we didn't call them gurus, but like the teachers would use to motivate you to be better. But it was this kind of mind control in a way too. And they were the people who were really into it. And the minute, if you questioned, you were just not, you were shutting yourself down to possibility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a, another great film. I think I'm trying to remember what was the moment that I kind of like, oh, I guess I can all of a sudden put my non-belief in a certain, can start framing that. I think it was an episode of Bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
And Penn and
Teller. Yeah.
And I remember years ago I heard about this guy, Randy James, who he has a great movie on Netflix called The Honest Liar.
Yeah, James Randy. Yeah, James Randy. The Illusionist. Yeah, sure. That's all right.
The Amazing Randy.
The Amazing Randy. Yeah, it's a great film, by the way, if you can find it still on Netflix.
And I knew about him because in Israel we had this huge celebrity called Uri Geller. Oh, yeah. The guy who would bend spoons with the power of his mind. And we were like, oh, my God.
Right up your alley.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was like this big celebrity because people were like, oh, my God, he has this mystical power and could do amazing supernatural things. And then James Randi came along and did that test, blind test, and proved, yeah, this guy is a total charlatan.
Yeah,
and I remember this guy. I was like, "Wow, that was amazing!" And years later, I heard about Penn and Teller and their show Bullshit, and I think they had Hitchens on the show, and they had a thing about Mother Teresa.
Right. Oh man, he had a thing for Mother Teresa.
Oh yeah, and I was, you know, I didn't know much about her, but I always thought, oh yeah, it's like that's like a.
Really if anybody cool. deserved to be a saint, it would be her. Yes,
clearly, and that kind of changed. But he said this one sentence. You know, he was, I don't know how many glasses of whiskey he had by that point, but he just said, very simply, faith is the surrender of the mind.
Mm.
And when he said that, I all of a sudden kind of like this wall came, and I was like, right. It just kind of like this
it one made sense.
Sense, this one sentence just clarified this approach. Like, yes, there's just so many things that don't make sense that you continuously have to try to, you know, reinterpret it, make do with some fake argument to try and accept that some people believe these things. But you, at a certain point, you have to accept that there's a certain point where the brain's like, you know what? I'm out. I have nothing. I can't explain it. I got nothing. So you got to make that step and you got to jump into this murky gray area where I can't help you there.
Right.
And like you said, when people are having delusions of these experiences, I absolutely believe that they are real to them.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, in terms of the, you know, the chemistry of the brain, they are real.
Yeah.
Like you are actually having whatever experience that is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you can tell a person, oh, that's not real. Like, no, I had that experience.
Yeah.
Right?
I believe you that you had it. It's just,
it doesn't correspond to anything out here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. In the world.
Yeah. We have the perspective, and then all of a sudden I became more like, right. This is like a way to remove ourselves from our own biases and have that's, you know, basically realize, oh, wait a minute. They kind of figured that out like thousands of years ago and it's called science.
Right. Yeah. And the way to remove your biases and see the world for what it really is. At least attempt to.
Yeah. At least, mm-hmm. but the thing was that the refreshing was like, actually being wrong is a, you know, by proving something wrong, it's a great battle. It's like, yes, congratulations.
It's a virtue.
It's a virtue. Like, great. And that was the one thing that living in the Middle East, you can't, everybody's pointing at each other saying, you're wrong.
Mm.
But because they think they're right.
Right.
It's not like you're wrong because this doesn't make any sense. Like, Muhammad didn't rose on a horse into the heaven. He didn't fly. This didn't actually happen. Or Moses didn't actually part the Red Sea, or all these magical things didn't actually happen. Or, you know, so at a certain point, they kind of like, you're wrong, because they look at that other story and go, that's ridiculous. But at the same time, they have this blind spot about their own beliefs.
The way that I would say back when I was a pastor that Mormonism was ridiculous while holding to my story, you know, which made perfect sense to me.
Yeah. Jesus took a left turn from the Middle East and then he saw, what is it, Utah, and he's like, oh, that's nice. I should...
Yeah, but there. First he went to New York and hid the plates in the backyard of Joseph Smith in New York, right?
Yeah.
Before they made the trek across,
And I thought,
that
you know...
makes much more sense.
Now. Yeah, but you know, compared to my world, you were like in a very archaic, sort of boring, old school style of like the one God belief, right? And it was just not creative enough.
Progressive and released.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, the fairies and all of that stuff. And I mean, anything you can imagine was... it was a lot more exciting.
Free game. Yeah. It's open. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you brought that keyboard along. And so we've been dancing around this song for the last half an hour. So would you play it for us?
Would you give your power?
I'll put some power into my power song.
And Ronan brought his cajon. So he's going to accompany. So
let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Better than I ever could. You know me better than you should. cross every single time. And like the best of them, you steal the best of me. But I've had enough of falling at your feet. Won't give my power to you. It's time for me to claim it. My power is bigger than you, not your entertainment. I'm taking back my freedom, taking back the freedom. There's nothing here for you, you know, nothing here for you. I'm taking back my freedom, taking back the freedom. The last thing on earth I'm gonna do is give my power to you. Puppet tied to your every word. I sacrifice the chance to be heard. Oh no, nobody in me now. Soul sucker, I'm not your clown. You can't keep dragging my heart around. You won't see me try to run, hide away. I meant to look you in the eye and say, won't give my power to you. Your entertainment. I'm taking back my freedom, taking back my freedom. There's nothing here for you, no, nothing here for you. I'm taking back my freedom, taking back my freedom. The last thing on earth I'm gonna do is give my power to you. Most precious thing I got, it's me. Won't give my power to you. It's time for me to claim it. My power is bigger than you, not your entertainment. I'm taking back my freedom, taking back my freedom. Nothing here for you, no opportunity for you.
That was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that was incredible. And I confessed earlier that I'm not a recording student, music recording artist. I can barely record this podcast. So,
I think you're doing great.
So it wasn't perfect, but it was in my dining room. So pretty damn good for my dining room.
Yep. Yep.
And I appreciate you, bringing your musical instruments and doing that. It was a real treat. And I hope everyone will go and find your music, GabbyGordon.com. And right. You have another band that you're part of as well. Talk to us a little bit about that in closing and what you guys are getting ready to do this summer.
It's pretty exciting. We've teamed up with another singer, a Danish artist called Morten Kier. And we have a band together, Ronan and I and Morten, and it's called Ebb and Flow. And we write songs together and then we go on tour. And we're going on tour in June. And we'll
and
be
all
gone.
The secular, yeah. Except we start in Israel, but then.
Yeah, we're starting in Israel in June and then working our way to Germany and Denmark and Belgium and.
Right as the U.S. campaign for the presidency is heating up, we're going to Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Fuck this.
Yeah.
We're out of here.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
The way it could have been.
Right. Right. You guys just need to come over here to Scandinavia and figure out how people really live.
Yeah.
Because every single report, now I'm tangenting again, but every single one of these life satisfaction reports comes back that these secular societies like Denmark and Sweden and Norway are far more healthy. People live longer. They're happier. They
they're more charitable.
They report more satisfaction with their life and all of that.
Yeah, so. I think that's true and not coincidental that they're also the least religious.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they've turned to other things to meet the needs that religion historically has met.
Yeah.
Needs for, you know, physical and mental and emotional support.
Yes.
Right. The government provides health care, so you don't have to worry about that. And you have other social supports provided by the society and then the need for stories about, you know, magic and all that kind of thing fade away.
And they have, you go to Denmark and there's like stories of you know, Thor and all the mythical, you know, Norwegian gods and Danish gods and Viking history. It's full of mythology, but
it's
understood that way. Yeah. And they're proud of it and they celebrate it.
I was in Sweden once, and was really hoping to see the gnomes, but I just didn't find them. I am so disappointed.
You weren't looking hard enough.
So I became a skeptic about gnomes.
Interesting.
There was no evidence. So are your songs that the music that you do with Ebb and Flow, is it, what kind of music is it?
It's, I would say, soulful pop music.
Yeah.
And
you have a following there that kind of waits for you to come back every summer?
You know, we have a really cool situation where we play to a lot of home concerts.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And we kind of go on this home concert tour. And a lot of it is influenced by Morten because he does a lot of workshops with a cappella choirs all over Europe, and he's kind of hot shit back there.
Wow.
And so that allows us a community of people who already appreciate music and vocal singing and is an attentive crowd, and then we get them to sing along, and it sounds beautiful, and it's very, you know, community.
Mm.
That
was great.
Ish and personal and intimate. So we get sort of the perfect experience.
Does Morten come here to do one on a part of this?
Well, we just did one this week at the Rockwell.
Oh, that's what I missed.
That was, yeah. Well, he's been living here for 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've been cultivating our, you know, sound and everything here, making the music, recording it, and then we go tour with it back in Europe.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a sweet setup.
And we can find your music with him online somewhere?
We haven't released it yet, but we will this summer.
Awesome.
But we have a Facebook, Ebb and Flow Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to follow us, they're welcome to. And we also do home concerts in the States in case people are interested in that.
So I'll put all the links in the show notes so people can just easily link to your solo work and also Ebb and Flow and... it's fantastic. I'm so glad that we got a chance to sit down and talk about all this. There's so much more. I mean, I could open another, you know, growler beer here. We could keep going for another couple of hours, but we all have a day to get to tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sure.
So.
No, thank you for giving us an opportunity to share some crazy stories. And
It's a fascinating story. I mean, this is what I love about what I do here because... I mean, where am I going to meet a Danish woman and an Israeli man who come from these wildly different backgrounds and then meet and your stories are still evolving, of course.
Yeah,
sure.
But you find this middle ground where your love of art meets your love of truth and yet, I mean, and I think, I mean, if we had another half hour, I would love to. Maybe we'll just do this again another time. I'm curious about this word spirituality because clearly the way you were practicing it and exploring it was sort of off the deep end in a kind of way and very harmful to you and others that were involved in that. But there is a kind of soulfulness. That, and I don't know what else, you know, that's kind of, again, a word that the root word is soul, which is a religious word, which we don't, I mean, I don't think that there's a soul per se, but we continue to use this word soulfulness to indicate something intangible about our humanity that is, you know, when even just this conversation we're having across the table, there's, a kind of, you know, empathy and connection and support, mutuality that we experience in life that is, I think, best evoked in poetry and music and art of other types, you know? And so it's interesting that you had this spiritual, so to say, experience that was really damaging. And then you've sort of given that up, thankfully, it sounds like. And then you continue to do something which in another way of using the word sounds somewhat spiritual in a way.
Yeah. I guess I could say shortly, I think it's just transformed into a much healthier self-searching. You know, I think that's ultimately what it is. And trusting oneself and, you know, so for example, when writing a song, it's no longer divine intervention I believe in. It's just learning to trust my own instincts and my voice and cultivating a healthy relationship with my, with myself and my thoughts.
And and I think even in the lyrics of the song we just heard, you know, it comes out like, I don't remember exactly what the lyrics are, but you say something about like, I'm like, you're enough. Like you're going to
taking back my freedom.
And, yes.
Yep. Yeah. The most precious thing I got is me.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. The most precious thing that any of us have is us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, the best gift we can give to another person is our true authentic self, right? Like unfiltered through some other kind of bullshit that, you know, sort of limits us and minimizes our identity.
That's beautiful, right?
It's beautiful. I think that there's a real, we still have these experiences when we play music. I think it's more of a consciousness thing. There's still a certain high. It's weird because you experience these, when you're playing, sometimes you're almost observing yourself doing this.
Right.
You're like, how is this happening right now?
Right.
You almost like you don't want to interfere with that side of you. You get a chance to experience something playing it. And I'm sure from the audience side, if you just kind of, I want to say let go and surrender, but, I think this is maybe why maybe artists are more prone to be susceptible to that spiritual or more magical kind of, because there's a certain real experience when you play music and you really, you know, we've had shows where we just play in someone's living room and there's no mics and it's all acoustic and it's just human voices in the room. And you know, even while I'm playing, you're kind of busy thinking about what you're doing, but just experiencing that. There's something really beautiful and amazing about that. Human, it's something I feel is very human. This music, this coordinating these sounds and voices. I mean, it's all around us in nature, and it's one of those early things we probably were able to communicate with sounds and voices, but speaking is like this more advanced, maybe updated version of our communication. But music feels almost like primitive and just kind of like one of our core
visceral.
So there's this experience where sometimes you get this real high when you perform, and especially when you can see it connecting with other people.
It's amazing. There's this word that was really taboo when I was religious, and now I see it as a good word, and it's this word carnal, and it means like fleshly,
earthly
and flesh, like sex is carnal. And I think music and art can be that way too. It channels that kind of direct connection to like love and beauty and all that stuff. So I don't know, I think it's great. And anyway, we could go on forever, but thank you guys so much for coming over. This has been great
for us too. Thank you so much.
Definitely, we'll have to do it again. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It was a real treat to have Ronan and Gabby over and to have them play music live in my dining room. You know, it's not a perfect recording, as I said, but, you know, we're not set up to record music. But it's pretty darn good for the system that we had here. And I just so appreciate them on the last sort of last minute coming over and doing that. I hope that you will, I beg you to go to Gabby's website, GabbyGordon.com. The link will be in the show notes. Check out all of her stuff. Her music is there. You can preview it. There's a link to where you can buy it on Bandcamp. Do that. Go to her website, buy her music. I hope the song that you heard here on this show is enough to get you to want to check out the rest of her music. That song, by the way, Power, hasn't been recorded that I know of. It's certainly not on her album that she has out right now. So you heard it here first, Power by Gabby Gordon. with Ronan Gordon on the cajon. It's an important song that impacted me back when I first heard it a couple of years ago, and I hope that it will resonate with you, many of you, and that it can be an anthem of sorts for getting your power back. If you want to learn more about Life After God, you can visit our website at lifeaftergod.org. All the links to our social media are there. Follow us and join the conversation. It's a lively conversation we have going on our Facebook page, and you can follow us as well on Twitter. There's a lot more to Life After God than just the podcast. Check out our website and learn more about what we're doing. Working on next week's podcast already. Just recorded a great conversation, and I look forward to bringing that to you next week. Until then, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been the Life After God podcast.